Welcome back to TV Campfire Podcast. This is podcast number 23, and I am Libya, your host. And this week we have a very special podcast, which is the podcast I promised you guys a while ago, the unedited version of the interview with the Eureka executive producers, Jamie Paglia and Bruce Miller. So jump in with both feet, and I hope you guys enjoy. I was trying to get the interview in before it premiered, but yeah. That didn't happen. So that's cool. But I mean, it's actually better because now I kind of have an idea of where you guys are going. So I think that's really great. And
to
I
let
just
us
want
to know if you have a good idea where we're going.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out. So.
Well, I mean, it's different. I mean, I watched the first three seasons of the show, and I was, you know, it's a good show. It's a fun show, and I really pretty much tell people that. But I have to say that this season has kind of taken off, and I can now just go to people, oh, you have to watch the show now.
It's all because of Bruce. It's all because of Jamie.
Nice. And I wanted to tell you that I have a friend who has never really watched the show. She watched like maybe one or two episodes, and she thought it was, all right. And then she watched the first two episodes, mainly because of James Callis. She's a fan. Mm-hmm. And she's like, this show is fantastic. She initially planned to just fast forward to his parts, and
good.
Got sucked into the story, wow. And she said, she's like, now I have to go back and watch the first three seasons. So I'd say that the story arc is working. My brother called me out of the blue and was like, are you watching that show, Eureka? And
oh,
I was like, yes,
that's
I am. And he's like, oh, the premiere was so great. So I'd say you guys are on the right track.
Thank you.
Thanks. I mean, I think everybody has been so excited about the reset. And when we had that sort of pin drop in the room, when we were talking about Founders Day and the idea of time travel and coming back, and I think everybody's sort of expectation was, okay, well, then you're going to come back and you're going to undo it. And it hit us that, or we don't undo it. We have ramifications that we'll get to explore for a while, and pretty much anything was open. And then it re-energized our cast, it re-energized our crew, and everybody has been bringing this amazing creative spirit to it that it's palpable. I mean, we had a sort of an impromptu premiere party, and our executives from the network and the studio all came, and they were just saying, it's like, you can feel it. And so far, the fan response has been really encouraging. I'm glad that they're enjoying it, because we're certainly enjoying making it.
Yeah, it's my first question is actually about the new story arc that you have going on. Eureka, for the most part, started off kind of episodic, and I'd say for the first three, they've had little arcs, mini arcs, I would say. This season really feels like now we're serialized. You know, it really feels like we have now gone from episodic to serialized. Is that the intention of this season? And
I wouldn't say that there was a specific intention. I think that we always had a mythology that we wanted to be following. So, you know, you're going to have a standalone nature to every episode.
Right.
You know, there's going to be an A-story problem that is presented that gets resolved. And ideally, there are some ramifications that carry over. But for the most part, anybody could come into an episode and enjoy that. But that we wanted to have multi-episode arcs for some of our characters. And I think that the nature of a first season show, especially one that does have an investigative nature to it, is that they want them to stand alone as much as possible. Part of that is that they want to be able to reorder episodes if they want to get the stronger ones up front, which is what happened with season one. And it really screwed up our mythology arc because they took five episodes and they went like this. You know, it was the shell game. And so the consortium storyline, the Beverly Barlow storyline, a bunch of those things that we were doing in the first two seasons were really dramatically affected because they had to get cut away. They just didn't make sense out of context. So it was definitely a desire of mine going into season two to be able to have more of the longer arc stuff built in so that they couldn't reorder episodes. And Bruce came on in the middle of that season as a consulting producer, and we would not let him leave again.
He was supposed to be here for 12 weeks.
Yeah. He's still talking to his agent. Get me out of this gig. How is it possible? Now I'm co-showrunner.
Like 12 weeks.
What the hell?
That's a long time.
Yeah. So, and I think that that's a huge part of this season creatively is was this new partnership of the two of us that, you know, Bruce is one of those people who came on and just got the show. He got the characters and the sensibility, and he brought, I think, a story mind to it that was essential in the direction that we've gone. And it's been great, you know, learning from him how he runs writers' rooms, having done 20 years of television and a lot of other shows. And, you know, I knew our show. You know, that's really the truth of it, and how I like to do things here. And I think that the combination of our backgrounds and sensibilities has made for a really great dynamic this year.
Can you give us a little background on Founders Day, since it was such a departure from what you guys have normally done, as far as, like, how you guys made those sets and how it looked? It looked really good. I mean, I could tell that there was green screen somewhere in the background, the big shots.
But couldn't tell
exactly where. Right. So how did you guys do that?
Well, it was a real our crew up in Vancouver kind of matched up with our post-production crew down here. Really, it was planning that made it possible. Yeah. Anytime a show departs from kind of, you know, I don't know how much your viewers know, but we have standing sets. We have a few sets that we build, we own, we do a lot of shooting on, you know, Carter, the sheriff's office, some things inside Global Dynamics. But other things, when you do go to other things, either you have to go to a location or you have to build something. And so since we had a lot of lead time before the first episode, once we decided that we would like to do something in 1947, we got to... We sat down and the special effects people had good conversations with the people who were building physical sets about how much they would actually have to build, right, and what they could do within our budgetary restrictions. And the result was that we probably the shots where we used visual effects or the shots of having exterior moments in 1947 were chosen 5 months before we finished the script. Because we needed to know very specifically how much time we could spend on what street, you know, whether we were doing it a day or night, how could we... And so it was being a show that's been on the air for a while and having all these people actually know what it entails to do a shot of a satellite dish, mm-hmm, and to have Jamie with all the experience with visual effects, which is just so rare, you know, in this, because visual effects keep coming...
Right.
They keep advancing so quickly. We were able to do it because we planned ahead and because we were able to incorporate all that support into the writing. If you write a script and then they just get it and they have to do it on the fly, you can't do it. You have to make all sorts of compromises.
And, you know, Matt Gore, who is our visual effects producer, and Kevin Little, who's one of his partners, we have, you know, this amazing visual effects team. Robert Petrovitz, who is our producer up in Canada, and Lance King, who's our production design team, and Rick McGuire, our director of photography, they all, you know,
and Matt Hastings,
got together,
the director of the episode,
who directed the episode and did an unbelievable job with it. And we were all able to really plan, like, what's going to be achievable. And, you know, this wasn't a concept of Founders Day, going back to 1947, was a concept that we had from season one. And we didn't want to do it in season one because we felt like we hadn't earned it yet. You really wanted to get to know the characters and the town and all those things. And then, you know, maybe in season two or three we'd go back. And we could never afford to do it. It was like every time you brought it up, it was like, it's too expensive. Period costumes, period cars, you know, army stuff, camp, you have to build it. We couldn't do it. And we had the opportunity to do a two-hour movie at first this year, which we ended up not doing. And Bruce had the idea of, you know, well, what if we do a version of Founders Day? Because then we could really embrace 1947 as a two-hour movie. And then when that sort of fell through, I was like, well, that's, now we can't do that. And he really pushed and said, well, what if we do it as a season premiere? We can maybe get a little bit more money and we can, you know, really kind of embrace it. And so we went for it. And I think that...
And it all kind of, the stuff about the changes in the timeline and all the stuff just came naturally out of that.
It really did.
And that's what we've been doing well this year, which is you asked about serialized versus standalone. We try just to follow what we think is cool.
Yeah, it's really it. I mean, I think that the network and the studio really challenged us during the off-season and said, look, if you get a season four, this is the one where you really need to step it up. You got to find, you know, something that's going to convince everybody that you're not just a season four and out show, but you're a season four, five, six, seven, eight potential show. And
we're very sorry they said that.
They basically said, you know, I think Mark Stern, he said something like, you know, think big or go home, and go big or go home. And we sort of had that lightning in the bottle moment of, we're going to bring them back, but we're going to shift all of them 90 degrees in their lives and their roles. It's the same town, it's our same people, but the dynamics are different now, and their roles are different, and they have to adjust to it. It just opened up this giant toy box that we could explore, and that's something that we could explore for many seasons.
And it's the thing that we do well on our show. Science fiction in movies is usually about the concept.
Right.
Science fiction on TV can be about the characters and how it affects you over the long haul. Because in a movie, they do time travel in a movie, you can always see how it affects those people over 2 hours. But we can do it over the long haul, and you get to see how complicated it would really make your life. Not really knowing your wife. Not really knowing, these things around town. And so we were able to do it on kind of explore smaller but very interesting parts of science fiction without having to do, the Death Star blowing up.
And I think the thing that was exciting about it was the positives and the negatives. Nobody has all good or all bad. It's, some of them are different. Some of them are, there are obviously for Jo, there are bigger stakes. She's lost this history with Zane. But it's complicated for Henry because he's now married to a woman he's never met, and all the
but he's kind of
fallen for her a little bit. And how do you negotiate that now? She has no idea what's happened. Do you tell her? Do you not tell her? What are the ethical and moral ramifications of that?
Do you sleep with her?
Do you sleep with her? Big question.
And how deal with it. We deal with it through the season.
Well, that actually leads me to my next question, which is now you have your conspiracy of six, which are, you have your characters who are now, at the end of the second episode, they're all sitting at the table trying to decide what to do, and they have their own, secret club, mm-hmm. So they're all part of this secret club, and I was wondering, how is that going to change their friendships? I mean, they were friends already, mm-hmm. but now they kind of have this thing that's kind of binding them together. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how that was going to change the dynamics, in addition to now that we all know, the entire group knows that Allison is not committed to the whole resetting of the timeline. Mm-hmm. She is kind of against the group. Mm-hmm. How does that change the relationships?
Well, it's exactly the way you said, which is it sharing a secret doesn't necessarily pull you together. I mean, it's hard for all of them because at different points they all want out, or they all want to tell somebody, or they end up telling somebody, and that endangers everybody. So it's once again, it's the character implications from a very simple concept, which is, okay, we can't tell anybody or we're all in trouble, but do I tell my wife?
Well, I mean, that's actually the one thing is, how are they going to keep this big secret? And my thing is, looking at the story, when I first looked at it, I was like, okay, most of them, I say, can probably keep the secret, except for Henry, because I don't believe that this woman who's married to him won't know that's not her husband.
She notices something's wrong from the third episode, from the second episode on.
Right.
From the second episode where she's like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you,
This week is...
Is the episode, because I was like, she should be the very first person who should be like, red flag.
Yeah, well, I mean, half the staff is married and knows that, when my wife has... a bad shoe day, I know about it just from my voice on the phone. Do you know these people fairly well, being married for 15, 16 years? And we wanted to make it real. And so you're exactly talking about all the stuff that we found fun, which was, so Henry, and then it's like, does he break up with her and kind of break her heart? It's not her fault. And does he owe something to the other Henry? It gets complicated, and we tried to just... Instead of just glossing over it all, just actually kind of think them through and say, well, what's the best choice you can make?
All right. Because I actually do like her character, and I could tell by the end of the second episode that he kind of liked her.
Locke is great. She was a great addition.
She's a spectacular actress, a very beautiful woman, and she is great with Jo. And they actually...
They have really good chemistry.
Set it up so that they didn't meet the first day they were working together until she rolled out from under that car. They had never met.
Oh.
So,
it's kind
of
cool.
His reaction is really his reaction of, oh, my gosh, that's her. So it worked out really, really well. It was part happenstance, part on purpose, but it was really funny.
Well, I was actually, my next question has to do with, now that you have your, also the other time loop thing, is you have the Global Dynamics changes from the fact that Fargo is now the head of Global Dynamics and the fact that Lupo is now the head of security. Head of security for Joe, Lupo totally makes sense for me. I can buy it. She can slide right in. No problems. Mm-hmm. Fargo, the head of GD, I just see hijinks, you know, just left and right from that. Mm-hmm. Is that pretty much where you guys are thinking?
Keep watching. It will not go.
It doesn't go the way you expect it to.
I think that, you know, one of the interesting challenges of putting these people in these new roles is how are they going to react to them? Are they going to walk away? Are they going to try to change them? Or are they going to somehow embrace them and grow into them? And how he got the job and now what does he do with the job are very big questions that we
And who was he in the job, if he starts to find out.
Well, I mean, just from what we've seen, it looks like he's kind of a power maniac, having people stand on one foot and stuff like that. The power seemed to have gone to his head. So that's kind of, and I could see our Fargo pretty much doing the same thing if given a chance. Okay.
what we try to do is, you know, you're exactly on the right track of how we think about these things, which is you just try to do the eureka version of how do you get used to a new job. And so we have an episode coming up, which is Fargo trying to figure out whether he can do this job. But it's our version of things, and how would that only happen in Eureka and would it only happen at GD? But it's exactly the same question, which is, do I walk away from this or can I do this? Some version of me could do this, so maybe I can do this.
The other question, this is strange, to me, is that Allison, from what I remember, is a physicist, so how is she now a medical doctor? How is she going to pull that off?
We established her actually in season one as a medical doctor.
A physicist?
Who had gone in a different direction. She had a career change.
I didn't remember that. My bad then.
Invincible, the episode with Carl Carlson. Carter's is avoiding getting his physical so that he can be signed on to the GD health insurance policy because he has a superstition that you know, you get a physical today, a cop takes a bullet tomorrow. And she says, okay, drop your pants. I'm going to do the physical right here. And he's like, I don't think so. And she's like, since when are you a doctor? And she's like, I used to be in a former lifetime. And it was sort of like that she had that career path for a long time, and then she had Kevin. And having a child with autism, you know, ended up making her make a career shift to be with him more. And she ended up being more of an administrator so that she could have a little more control of her schedule. So that's actually, we've never established her as a physicist. That was more Nathan Stark.
Okay, she gets into the conversation, so I kind of thought of that. Yeah. That in my head,
she's
that's
very bright. She can speak Dutch, too.
That's true.
That is so random.
It's one of her many languages.
But now that you're talking about Kevin, I wanted to ask a question. When you guys presented an interesting perspective with Kevin's autism, saying that basically now that in this alternate timeline that all of a sudden doesn't have autism, which leads you to believe that it's environmental versus genetic. And I was wondering if you guys foresaw any kind of controversy, feedback from people about that.
You know, it's not that we're saying that it's environmental versus genetic. It's that we're saying that, and this is something that we're actually incredibly sensitive to.
Mm-hmm. We did a lot of research, and I think almost everybody on the staff has either a relative with autism. So we didn't attack this lightly. We wanted to make it as we wanted to show some sensitivity as we touched on it.
My wife Kristen, her doctorate from Harvard is in working with kids with autism. I mean, that's been her focus. We looked at this from a lot of different angles, and what we didn't want to do was say that in our world of Eureka, we can now cure autism.
And we're not sharing it with the rest of the world.
We're not going to share it with the rest of the world. The truth is, where current research stands, we don't know exactly how much is environmental, how much is genetic.
Right.
Are there markers? Are you predisposed in some ways? And then if you're exposed to various things, could those be the triggers that actually sort of tip whether it happens one way or another? So the way that we approach it is that, you know, you've got all these different switches, some environmental, some genetic, and we don't know which are which. And in this particular change, some of those switches didn't get tripped, and that's, you know, that's why he has changed. But the how and the why of it, we don't want to say, you know, because we don't know.
And yeah, we definitely wanted to make it that from the way things are now, there seems to be a myriad causes of autism, and some combination of things have to happen, not just one thing. So we wanted to just say, at least with current understanding, our explanation was that something didn't
happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
And whether it was a genetic or an environmental thing, we have no idea. I mean, Kevin could be slightly different genetically, but the story is really a character story. It's about Allison much more than
right. It is. I was just wondering, if you had any feedback about that.
Yeah, we've had a lot of feedback. There's been some really interesting debates online.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, we've had very interesting debates in the writers' room about all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the debates online have reflected. They've teased it apart with the care that we put it together, so we're very impressed with how much attention the fans have paid to the very careful parsing of words, that no one is saying that he was sick and now he's better, and no one's saying he was...
We're not saying we fixed Kevin.
We fixed Kevin, or he wasn't normal. We're saying that Allison is very happy to have... to understand, to be able to see the world the way he sees it.
Connect with him in a way that she hasn't been able to before.
So did he do it on purpose?
That's the question.
I didn't think you guys were actually going to tell me, but I figured I'd ask.
But wouldn't it be cool?
Well, it seemed
smartest
like it.
Smartest kid in town.
So yeah, crazy. It really seemed like it, because there's that moment where he said, the day's not over. And I was like, what?
That was
interesting. you were mentioning Joe and Zane about... now they're back to square one. And I guess, to me, the way I see it is they have a couple of different ways they can go. Like, basically, Joe could just forget about it and just not do anything. I personally have the inclination to believe that she might now take the courage to pursue Zane. That's how I see it. I could be totally wrong, but...
Well, the question is, why did she hesitate? Why didn't she say yes?
Because it's Joe. That doesn't surprise me.
That's one possibility. Or is it that there was something that she felt was not right, and now she's going to come to deal with what is the aspect of that relationship that made her...
Hesitate.
And the exploration of that is something that we are embracing.
And it's been a spectacular season for...
Erica's doing. I mean, all of our cast has been so, I think, reinvigorated by this, that they've been doing their best work. I think Erica in particular has really...
She got a promotion out of the deal, so yeah.
That's right.
Niall as well has been doing spectacularly, and his character had to change quite a bit.
Yeah, he had to. He basically backed up to where he was in the beginning, which is where he was kind of unlikable.
Yeah.
It's trying to find a balance between being completely bad boy, or being somewhere in between where he was
a jerk
when we first met him and where he was when we left him.
But in terms of what you were asking, it's turned into one of the most... We were just having this discussion in the other room.
Yeah,
one of the most interesting, most complicated relationships that I've ever worked on in television,
and
all the shows that I've been on, because it's they keep... She's a very difficult personality, just in general. She's tough to get to know, and she is very sure of herself in some ways and not in other ways. And he's very, very intelligent and starts to figure out something's going on. There's something that she knows that he doesn't know. And there's certainly chemistry between the two of them. But as far as he's concerned, they've been enemies since he arrived. So that relationship, whenever we think we've got our finger on it and say, oh, okay, this is where it's going, someone turns in a script where just the dynamics are so interesting, you're like, well, now it's going
in
that direction.
Maybe we'll push it more that way.
So the characters and the actors are really guiding us through that. I think just like a real relationship, we have no knowledge of the future just like they don't.
We have chosen a direction that we are pushing them in, but it's been interesting watching the evolution of it as it plays out. And luckily we've had a short hiatus between shooting the first 10 episodes and the back 10 episodes and seeing how things actually have developed on screen with them. And it's definitely influenced the direction that we're going in.
Well, speaking of relationships, because I like Joe and Zane, but my relationship that I really like, of course, is Carter and Allison. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I've watched a million dramas, and they always have something that keeps the main two characters apart. I have to give credit to this show in that you guys have had legitimate, real, natural, organic mm-hmm. things that have come between the characters that actually don't really make me upset, I guess, because I've watched shows where they put so many obstacles, I'm just like, I'm done. I don't care anymore, right. Whatever. And I have to say, on this show, introduction of Stark, which totally worked for me because I liked him.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, all right. And everything that's happened has felt like a natural block between those two characters. Oh, this season with the whole time loop thing, and I was like, really? Come on. You know, and I feel like you got to give me something.
Yeah?
You know, I really...
You didn't like the kiss?
All right.
I love the kiss. Are you kidding me? that was great. And I was like, yes. And then Tess comes back, and I'm like, oh. So, I mean, because Tess was last year. Tess was mm-hmm. the, you know, the thing keeping them apart last season. And I understand this season what you're trying to do. I just know I'm starting to get a little bit frustrated, but I love the kiss. You're right. Totally 100% on board with that. Just give me something.
Well, Jamie, you know, when Jamie created the show, he set up the dynamic between the two of them, like you said, is great because I could always inside my own head make the argument like, oh, they should be together, and then would that really work out? I mean, look at she lives in this very rarefied world of the right. very intelligent, and he's a very down to earth guy, and yeah, on paper they like each other, there's chemistry, but would it really work out? And you can understand the hesitation. And so when things get in the way, you know, the way that Jamie set it up, it really yeah. works, because it would be tough
not
to take that step.
Well, we all, yeah, well, like co-creating.
It does. I totally agree.
But we...
Now, though, I'm starting to go, let's...
And we definitely... I think everybody who's on the show is a fan of the show as well, and we try to experience it as fans, and I would advise you to keep watching.
I don't think you're going to be disappointed.
Yay.
we have no interest in stringing the audience along.
We don't want to annoy anybody.
Either the way that... believe it or not, as much as a show is sort of an evolving, you know, creature unto itself, and you don't quite, you know, you steer the direction of it, but it surprises you, and you sort of follow instincts as things come up, like we were saying with Joe and Zane. But the plan that was sort of laid out of a possible future for Carter and Allison in the season one finale, Once in a Lifetime, 4 years in the future, was something that we've been very careful to sort of move in steps toward a version of that future, and we've seen along the way pieces of it that have changed, right? We know, yes, there was Allison did end up getting pregnant, and didn't end up being Carter's child. He did end up being a paternal figure in a very different role than we saw in that particular future. Zoe did actually evolve to a point where she excelled in her scholastics, and now she's going off to Harvard. I mean, so we've chosen pieces of those, of that future, and have tried to hit those mile markers along the way. But mostly we wanted to earn the relationship between Carter and Allison.
Right.
And we wanted it to feel organic, and I think, you know, many people have those unrequited relationships in their lives that for whatever reason timing didn't work out. And I'm glad that you feel like we've sort of organically managed to make that work.
So far, like I said, it totally has worked for me. And at this point on other shows, I'd be ready to, you know, turn the channel. But on this one, it really does feel like the characters still care about each yeah. other, and it doesn't feel false.
Well, so. Colin and Sally are both spectacular actors,
yeah,
and bring a lot of layers to that kind of relationship that only a good actor can bring, that make it possible for you to realize that they mesh in some ways and don't mesh in other ways, and it makes it satisfying and frustrating at the same time.
It's interesting, you know, in terms of natural obstacles that come up. The truth is, we were in the middle of breaking the episodes for season three when Sally called me and said, "Are you sitting down? I'm pregnant." And the direction that we were going to go in the back 10 episodes for that season completely changed because of that, because we decided to embrace the pregnancy. And we thought, all right, we can hide this, But if we're gonna, you know, it never looks right, and it'll be distracting. And we thought, well, this is really interesting with, you know, Stark's death, and then the discovery for her. Just as there's like this sort of mourning period has gone by, and maybe there's a possibility for them to get together, that she discovers that she's pregnant with Stark's child, and how does Carter react to that? And it was really interesting, I think, to see the characters. Relationship deepen as he stepped into that role of, well, I'm going to be here for you as a friend and whatever you need. And, you know, obviously there's this sort of underlying romance that is, you know, under the surface that you want to happen. You know, when she gives birth in episode 16 and they have that moment, they're stuck down there together and she says, you know, this isn't how I pictured things going for us. And it's like bad timing. But there was such a nice affection between the two
right.
of them. I mean, it just really felt honest. And but because of all of those things now, where they are literally four seasons later, it's open to that possibility. I
have a question about Fargo. One of my guests on the podcast has noticed that Fargo has become more nude recently. He's been in a lot of episodes without clothing, and we were wondering, is that a request by the actor or by the fans?
Gosh, neither.
He's hilariously funny,
and he's up for anything.
And he's up for anything. And I think that we laugh when he does naked things, and so we continue to do them. It's just like destroying Carter's Jeep. It's something that,
that
gets
a laugh.
Yeah, that
does happen a lot.
Yeah. And Neil, who plays Fargo, is just... he's spot on in terms of the tone of his humor.
Yeah.
And that just... although it is a pleasure to watch him walk around naked.
He is a very attractive man. Don't think we haven't noticed Neil. Yeah, I think that part of it is because you discover a funny moment that you want to do. And like for us,
and nothing makes it funnier than to just
add a
and someone's naked.
But yeah, I mean the Terminator gag was something that when we were, of course, doing the time travel of it, and a good friend of mine, James Middleton, was one of the showrunners on Sarah Connor Chronicles, and he had developed Terminator 3 and 4 of the movies, and so that was sort of his baby. It was a little bit of a nod to him in that show, obviously, since we're in the same kind of sci-fi world and that particular kind of storyline. But you know, there's nothing funnier than shooting at 4 a.m. and it's 40 degrees outside, and you've built this camp, and it's raining. Then Neil coming out in his robe and his slippers and saying, "Okay, on your mark, Neil," and he strips that thing off. And you know, he's such a gamer. There are a whole bunch of different things that an actor can wear to obscure, you know, for modesty.
Yeah.
And he chose the one that was the least amount of material possible because he didn't want to have a line or anything.
He really was like some other reason, but go.
No, so basically what he had, it was like a little tiny bit of fabric and like a little plastic, the clear plastic loop that went around half of his body, and that was the other half was, and he went out there and just over and over again with a smile on his face, he thought it was the best thing.
And
so.
You see it once, and he has to do it 30 times.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, he
rain.
Got to be the Terminator, though. That's pretty
he
cool.
did get to be the Terminator, which was hilarious.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Dr. Trevor Grant,
yes,
played
James
by Mr.
Callis.
James Callis.
Spectacular James Callis.
Yeah, that was my question. Where is this? I mean, of course fans are going to compare him to Baltar, because you have to, mm-hmm. to some degree. He's a little bit smarmy, a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not exactly evil, but a little bit self-serving.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things are in common. So mm-hmm. where are you going with this guy?
I've modeled him after me. Smarmy and self-serving.
You know, I think that we all just loved James as an actor. I mean, his talent is just so fantastic.
And a Battlestar, but beyond Battlestar. I mean, he's just been in everything we've seen him, and he's just spectacular and different, and he's a treasure.
So when we were creating the character... you know, that we sort of had a Cary Grant kind of figure in mind, and We looked at a lot of different people who came in, but when his name came up, it was, I think, the one that we just all said, oh, that's the one, you know. And we had lunch with him, and we talked to him about what we wanted the character to be, but and he wanted to make sure that he felt, you know, he understood what we were hoping for. And mostly we just said we wanted him to bring himself into it and create a character that that would resonate with everybody. But we didn't, we gave him an archetype and the words.
And he turned it into a person.
Turned it into a real three-dimensional character.
And it's a complicated character. Here's a guy who's like you said, he has an outsized ego. Mm-hmm. But he's a man out of time. But he's also a man who always wanted to kind of see the future.
With the flying cars.
With the flying cars. So it isn't really the future he wanted. And then as we go through, we peel back more layers to him. But I think that he's uniquely qualified to be someone who's moved into the future, because yeah. He certainly, his brain has been in the future for a long time. But he's still a man out of time, and he's a man completely alone. Doesn't have any of his friends or family around.
And there's that discovery that happens for him over the course of these episodes.
Oh, I was like, there's a discovery. I was like, did I miss that?
Yeah. No,
oh,
okay. It's kind of sad. I mean, it's kind of sad.
You'll see this week's episode is, there are a lot of seismic revelations again this week.
And one more character question, which is Robot Andy. He is fantastic. And I'm so glad you guys brought him back. He's like, he was my favorite new character that you introduced in, like, one episode, and then you killed him, and I was like, what?
That's the great thing about it. We didn't kill him. We killed him, like, 4 or 5 times.
That's right. But then he decides to go off. That's right.
We killed him.
We
killed him 3 or 4 times.
Right.
Because he didn't know if he was
built for this job. He wanted to go sit in his box for a while or whatever.
That's right. He needed some alone time.
Oh, my God. He is great.
He's great. And
so he's back for the season because he's the deputy, right?
We're using him quite a bit this season. We found that he's... It's an only in Eureka kind of character, but he's very natural and feels fits in well, and he can do all sorts of things that serve dramatic purposes. And sadly, you know, you'll see as the season goes along, he dies a whole bunch of times.
Oh, that's your joke.
He dies over and over and over again, which is the beauty of having a robot deputy.
That's true.
That he's you know, he can die and
they just
rebuild
him,
be resurrected, and you know, reskinned. So you never know.
Don't say that.
Man, woman, tall, short.
One question I was wondering. I asked this question of some of the Battlestar writers, and I asked them, you know, what are the favorite TV shows that they watch? And I'd like to ask you guys the same question. What do you turn on when you go home?
Do you want to go first?
Sure. I was and still am a huge fan of Battlestar. I just thought it was a spectacularly written show, incredibly well acted, and just beautifully made television by professionals. It was great. Warehouse 13 is a sci-fi show that they do a terrific job and is one of our sister shows, and I enjoy it quite a bit. Dexter. I don't ever miss Dexter. The Wire, which is off the air now, which I miss.
The Battlestar writer said The Wire too.
Yeah, that was it's. But you know, character-driven television was always what I always have been attracted to. I'm not much of a procedural person, mm-hmm. The shows on USA are Monk. Is still a fantastic show, even in reruns. Royal Pains and Drop Dead Diva and the other shows that they do are very good.
I knew that everyone except for Drop Dead Diva, because that's reality, right?
Nope.
It isn't?
Nope.
Yeah, I
have to go look it up.
Yeah,
and we can't wait for the event.
That's great.
But
I saw the trailer for that.
Our friend Nick Waters, who was on staff last season, created the event. It's going to be great.
And and his offices are literally
downstairs,
beneath our feet right now, and we
and Dexter. So you can go downstairs.
We try desperately to steal scripts and look at the call sheet to find out what's going on. And
I think for me, in addition to the shows, I mean, again, I think everybody on the staff love Battlestar. We know that all those guys. We know Ron and David and the writers, and we shared sound stages and post-production facilities with them for the first 3 seasons that we did our show too. So it was a bar-setting show, I think. shows that I like to watch, you know, regularly. Big Love is fantastic. United States of Tara, Dexter,
Mad Men,
The Office, 30 Rock. What else am I watching right now? Oh, True Blood. Yeah, I mean those.
The last episode was pretty good.
It was pretty good. So there's a sampling.
But nice. I have young children, and so does Jamie. I have my son Ben is 14, and Duncan 11, and Tess is 5. So there's a lot of shows that I watch on a regular basis that I wouldn't normally watch because they watch them.
Right.
But that I really, you know, enjoy. I watch, you know, MythBusters, which
right.
I love, which
right.
I never would have started to watch, Dirty Jobs, all these shows that they brought to me. You know, Avatar, the cartoon.
Airbender.
You know, yeah,
mm-hmm.
never missed an episode. But and those, I think, because I have children and they control the television, I watch those shows on a regular basis, and I have to say I enjoy those shows.
Yeah.
SpongeBob. I love SpongeBob.
All right, final question. What can you tell us about the upcoming seasons? Any hints or anything you want to tell the fans to tease us?
I think that...
Don't get married to the name Eureka. No.
That's right. Something's going to change. I think mostly what we wanted to do this season was really stretch ourselves. And if there was anything that that I didn't love about where we were sort of in the last seasons, where I think we fell into a little more of a formula than I ever wanted us to. And if we're going to be doing, you know, an homage to a particular kind of episode this week, we're sort of doing a little homage to 28 Days Later.
Oh, zombies.
Wanted to embrace it and go for it. I mean, really push ourselves, not be afraid to do different visual styles, different camera movements, different, just really, really coloring
the, let the story kind of
sort of dictate, yeah. And to have ramifications to each episode that carry on for our characters. And I think that that was a big part of the reset, was that we didn't just want to come back and at the end of one or two episodes go, oh, we can undo it all, and we're just back to normal, and here we go again.
So don't get your hopes up.
It's going to be it's going to be a journey this season.
It's an amazing season. The staff has been amazing. They've delivered great. Every episode is cool and amazing in its own right. I think ramifications are that things that happen change stuff. And they continue to change stuff moving forward. It's, you know, Carter and Allison kissed each other in 1947. So, what, 73 years later?
63 years later.
63 years later, the repercussions of that are going to play out through the season.
When the network asked us what we were going to do this season, and we told them, and then sort of the end of our pitch was, it's same town, big changes.
Yeah.
And that's going to play out.
All right, I'm excited. I mean, like I said, my brother, who barely was watching the show and he rarely calls me, got on the phone and was like, "Oh my God, are you watching Eureka?"
He should call you more.
I'll play this video for him.
Please.
I mean, there we're going to be
call, please.
There will be darker mysteries that, you know, we've had in seasons past that sort of disappear that will start to resurface. There will be longer arcs and mini arcs, and there will be lots of guest stars.
Lots of
Will Wheaton
stars.
Is coming up this week. It's fantastic. Jamie Kennedy is coming to play with us. We're going to have other big cast surprises coming up, and one that we are hopefully going to be announcing at Comic-Con. So it's look out, coming for you.
But moving forward, I just would say you don't want to miss the episodes this year, especially if you've seen the first two, because we went for it after that. You know, it's once you get kind of the cast has been spectacular, and once they decided to really bring it and showed us how amazing the character changes could be, it's been a spectacular year.
I think all the
technical stuff, you know, if you saw the special effects, especially Tiny in the second episode. Of that robot walking down the street,
yeah.
Which is a complete visual effect.
Best line ever, bad robot.
Little nod to Joss. Come on, we had to do it.
No,
that's
J.J.
Abrams.
Excuse me, to J.J.
Bad robot.
That was, you know, we had to give a little homage.
Yes.
There. But I think that one of the things that was great about the reset was just like anything's possible. And that's what we get to
and
do.
And anything so. Happens. And more.
Anything happens.
But it gets, but I think for what we're trying to do is reward viewers that have been watching consistently and also just really, really excite viewers who are new. You know, we want our episodes to be incredibly enjoyable if it's the only one you see all season, and also incredibly enjoyable and incredibly satisfying if you've been watching all the way along.
Yeah.
So you're trying to do both.
It's been nice. Like what you said about your brother and others is, has been something that we're hearing a lot, which is great. I mean, we really intended for this to be a season where new people could come and discover the show and not feel like they were way,
they really
way far
have.
Behind. And I'm glad that's happening because it's going to be a great ride if you just started with episode one of season four. But there will be, you know, there will be those little sort of gifts along the way for people who've been watching for a long time.
All right. I'm looking forward to it.
Keep watching.
And if you guys have any questions or comments about the interview you guys just listened to, let me know. You can send any feedback to tvcampfire@gmail.com. And I'll talk to you guys next week.